The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and also from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first article is going to be a short article entitled Research We're Watching from the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2021. It's called Sensing Abnormal Heart Rhythms with a Smart Speaker. Smart speakers like Alexa and Google Nest come in handy for playing music or setting alarms with voice commands. But these popular devices may one day hear your heartbeat and detect irregular heart rhythms, a new study suggests. Researchers programmed a smart speaker to emit an inaudible sound that bounces off a person sitting 1 to 2 feet away and back to the speaker. Artificial intelligence programs detect a heartbeat from the person's chest wall sounds and then analyze the time between heartbeats, which enables the system to identify abnormal rhythms. They tested the system in 26 healthy people and 24 people hospitalized with heart conditions like atrial fibrillation and heart failure. The smart speaker closely matched the beats detected by standard heartbeat monitors. Currently, the system performs occasional spot checks of a person's heart rhythm, but the scientists are planning future versions that could continuously monitor heartbeats when people are sleeping, which might help diagnose conditions like sleep apnea. They published their findings the March 9, 2021 issue of Communications Biology. Now from the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2021, here's an article called Can a Diabetes Drug Transform the Treatment of Obesity? In studies, a weekly injection caused dramatic amounts of weight loss and improved other heart-related risk factors. For treating most conditions closely linked to heart disease, a two-pronged approach works best: lifestyle changes and medication. For obesity, however, the currently available drug options just aren't very effective. But that may soon change if a high-dose version of semaglutide, a drug originally developed to treat type 2 diabetes, gains FDA approval for treating obesity. Semaglutide works by mimicking a substance called GLP-1, which is made naturally by the gut and the brain. It prods the pancreas to release insulin when blood sugars rise too high. It also reduces appetite and helps you feel full following a meal. A weekly injection of semaglutide, marketed under the brand name Ozempic, is approved for people with diabetes and causes modest weight loss. But a higher dose induces a weight loss of 15% of a person's body weight, on average over a period of about 16 months, according to two large trials published earlier this year. There is no question that semaglutide is far more effective than any other anti-obesity medication we have now, says Dr. Lee Kaplan, who directs the Obesity, Metabolism, and Nutrition Institute at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Still, there's a lot of variability in how people respond to the drug. Some people may lose no more than 5% of their weight. But in others, the drug may be as effective as weight loss surgery, which typically helps people shed at least 30% of their weight. A truly effective weight loss drug could help change how people think about obesity, says Dr. Kaplan, which he stresses should be distinguished from the socially driven desire to lose weight. People need to recognize that obesity, defined as excess weight that poses a risk to health, is a disease that has to be treated in the classic medical sense if we want to provide patients with the optimal benefit. It's a serious problem given that more than 40% of adults in this country have obesity. Like diabetes, obesity changes the body so it doesn't function normally. And that underlying problem has got to be corrected. And similar to how doctors treat high blood pressure and elevated cholesterol, treatment for obesity may require more than a single drug, and it may last indefinitely. Taking this new drug is generally easy and painless. You inject yourself in the abdomen or thigh using a pen-like device with a tiny needle the size of a human hair. Side effects such as nausea and diarrhea are common soon after starting the medication, but they usually resolve in a month or two. People with obesity frequently have other health problems like high blood pressure and elevated cholesterol, which are caused or made worse by the obesity, says Dr. Kaplan. Studies suggest that people who undergo weight loss surgery may lower their risk of heart disease by 60%. That's 60%. Having a drug available that comes close to delivering a degree of weight loss similar to surgery is reason for great optimism, he says. Then there is an attached section called A Game-Changing Drug for Obesity. Currently available anti-obesity drugs help people lose an average of only about 5 to 8% of their body weight over a course of treatment. But results from two recent studies of the diabetes drug semaglutide look far more promising. Both included people with obesity, which means a body mass index of 30 or greater. Or they could have had a body mass index of 27 or higher and one weight-related health problem, like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or sleep apnea. Remember that the BMI is a measure of weight in relation to height. The first study, published online February 10, 2021 by the New England Journal of Medicine, included 1,961 adults. All participants received counseling focused on improving their diet and their exercise habits, along with weekly injection of 2.4 milligrams of semaglutide, or a placebo, for 68 weeks. Those 75% of those taking semaglutide lost more than 10% of their initial weight, and one-third lost more than 20%. In the second study, published online February 2021 by JAMA, the same dose of semaglutide was tested in 611 adults who followed a moderately low-calorie diet for 2 months, in addition to receiving intensive behavioral therapy. The therapy included 30 counseling sessions during the 68-week-long study. Those taking semaglutide lost an average of 16% of their body weight, compared with 5.7% among those who got intensive behavioral therapy. Weight loss with semaglutide was also linked to improvements in blood pressure, cholesterol, and inflammation. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2021 is entitled Diastolic Blood Pressure, Worth a Second Look? Recent findings point to possible harm from very low diastolic blood pressure, the second number in a blood pressure reading. Current blood pressure guidelines define an ideal reading as less than 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury. According to some research, an even lower systolic value may help prevent heart attack and stroke. But more aggressive treatment to lower systolic blood pressure makes sense only as long as you don't develop symptoms like feeling lightheaded or dizzy. But when it comes to diastolic pressure, lower is not necessarily better. A study found that a very low diastolic blood pressure, less than 60, was linked to an increased risk of heart attack and stroke in people at high cardiovascular risk. The safety of a low diastolic blood pressure value has been debated for decades, says Dr. Randall Zussman, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. In general, doctors and patients alike tend to focus more on systolic blood pressure, which reflects the amount of pressure in the arteries as the heart contracts and squeezes blood out of the body. Diastolic pressure is measured as the heart relaxes. It affects the amount of blood flowing into the arteries supplying the heart, which doctors refer to as coronary reperfusion. If your heart's arteries are clogged with fatty deposits, as happens in heart disease, blood pressure beyond the constricted areas will fall even lower as blood flows through the narrowed channels. That's why we worry that if diastolic pressure gets too low, that might compromise the heart's function, says Dr. Zussman. The JAMA Network Open Study relied on data from two earlier studies that included just over 7,500 people at high risk for heart disease. All received medication to lower their systolic blood pressure to less than 130 millimeters of mercury. Researchers found that people with a diastolic value below 60 had higher rates of heart attack, stroke, and death from any cause. Those with diastolic values from 70 to 80 had the lowest risk. The findings jibe with earlier studies showing similar results. Still, the new study didn't necessarily consider all the variables that might explain the finding. Doing so isn't possible in so-called retrospective studies, which rely on previously collected data, says Dr. Zussman. As the authors conclude, the possible dangers of very low diastolic blood pressure merit further study. However, testing that hypothesis in a clinical trial isn't feasible because it's very difficult to intentionally and selectively lower diastolic pressure. All currently available blood pressure drugs lower the systolic and the diastolic blood pressure. But what does this mean for people with high blood pressure? Everyone's different, so when choosing your blood pressure medicine and setting your target, your doctor should consider your individual situation. That includes any other health conditions, sensitivities to drugs, and likelihood of developing dizziness or other side effects. The goal is to lower your systolic reading below 130 to reduce your risk of heart attack and stroke without triggering dizziness, lightheadedness, or fainting. In general, systolic pressure tends to rise with age, while diastolic pressure tends to fall. Sometimes when diastolic pressure dips below 60, the systolic reading is around 90 to 95. If that's the case, easing up on blood pressure treatment makes sense. But if your systolic pressure is well controlled and your diastolic reading is below 60, it's worth asking your doctor to listen very carefully to your heart to make sure your aortic valve isn't leaking. This problem, known as aortic regurgitation, interferes with normal blood circulation throughout the heart, causing diastolic pressure to fall. But if your aortic valve is in good shape and you can be physically active without any symptoms like chest pressure, shortness of breath, or lightheadedness, a low diastolic blood pressure should not pose a problem. Next, from the June 2021 issue of Harvard Heart Letter, here's an article that's going to be useful in the summer. It's entitled, "Have a Safe Trip." Here is some air travel advice for people with cardiovascular risks before, during, and after the flight. Weary of pandemic-imposed staycations, many people are eager to visit distant relatives and plan vacations. If you travel by plane, health experts recommend waiting at least 2 weeks after you're fully vaccinated against COVID-19. If you have any heart-related condition, consider this additional advice. Control your stress, mind your medications, and quell your blood clot concerns. And if needed, start getting in shape even before you book your flight. Stay calm. Air travel has always been taxing, with cumbersome luggage, long security lines, and flight delays. The added COVID-19 restrictions can make people even more anxious. Stress strains your cardiovascular system. So make an effort to remain as relaxed as possible. Bring your favorite music, a good book, or anything else that distracts you and puts you in a calmer state, says cardiologist Dr. Gregory Piazza, associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Check any heavy bags so you don't have to struggle to get them into the overhead compartment. Drug policy. Remember to bring all your prescription drugs in your carry-on bag, making sure you have extra doses in case of delays. It's safer and in many states and countries required to leave them in the original labeled container. If you're moving across multiple time zones, timing your doses can be a little tricky. Keep a watch or travel clock on your home time zone and aim to take your next dose roughly in the midpoint of your home time and your destination time. If you take multiple drugs with different dosing schedules, ask your pharmacist or cardiologist for advice. Blood clot concerns. Many people have heard about someone who developed a leg blood clot during a long flight. This problem, known as deep vein thrombosis, causes pain, swelling, and redness in the affected limb. Many factors raise the risk of deep vein thrombophlebitis, including age, family history, and chronic conditions like obesity, cancer, and kidney disease. Immobility and dehydration may provoke clots in susceptible people, but the overall risk is very low. Sometimes people don't drink fluids because they want to avoid needing the restroom. A bad idea because the air on planes is very dry. I tell my patients who had clot problems in the past to remember to cha-cha, which stands for compression, hydration, and ambulation. In other words, wear compression stockings, drink plenty of water, and get up and move around every hour or so. The evidence supporting compression stockings actually isn't very strong, but the stockings help prevent the ankle swelling that often occurs on long flights. People with a history of DVT often worry that their thick ankles are a sign of another clot, so wearing the stockings can ease unneeded concerns, Dr. Piazza says. In a similar vein, there's not much proof that the calf exercises often recommended by in-flight magazine articles are all that helpful. But if you're on a long flight and aren't able to walk around every hour or so, flexing your feet and circling your ankles can help increase the circulation in your legs. The trick is remembering to keep doing the exercises throughout the flight, says Dr. Piazza. There's an accompanying short article that says, "Are you fit enough for your destination adventures?" Strolling on a beach or through a museum isn't all that taxing, but if you're planning a more active vacation, make sure you're in good enough shape. Even going to Disney World with your grandchildren may involve much more walking than you're normally used to, says Dr. Gregory Piazza, a cardiologist with Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Likewise, travel tours popular with older adults may involve lots of walking and hiking, he notes. What about high-altitude destinations like the Colorado Rockies or Machu Picchu? The higher the altitude, the less oxygen in the air. In response, your heart rate and blood pressure rise temporarily until your body adapts to the lower oxygen level, usually within a few days. As a general rule, don't go above 8,000 feet the first day, and give your body time to adapt before going higher or doing any strenuous hiking. Ascending up to 12,000 feet is considered fine for most people with stable heart disease. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2021 is entitled, Treating Sleep Apnea, Good for Your Heart and Mind? This often unrecognized sleep disorder raises your risk of heart disease as well as depression. Loud snoring, choking sounds, and scary pauses in breathing during sleep are classic signs of obstructive sleep apnea, a condition that affects about 1 in 12 Americans. Often people don't notice these symptoms themselves, but only learn about them from a bed partner or a family member. Left untreated, the condition can have serious health consequences. In people with sleep apnea, soft tissue at the back of the throat temporarily blocks the airway during sleep. The resulting pauses in breathing, called apneas, occur repeatedly throughout the night, sometimes up to 100 times an hour. Next day grogginess, morning headaches, fatigue, and frequent nodding off are the only part of the problem. Falling asleep while driving a car is perhaps the gravest threat. But sleep apnea takes a toll on both your heart and your brain. Every breathing pause triggers a rise in your heart rate and blood pressure, says Dr. Sogal Javahari, a sleep specialist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Frequent or long apneas can cause your oxygen levels to dip, she says. Over time, the stress on your cardiovascular system can damage your blood vessels and your heart muscle. People with sleep apnea face a heightened risk of high blood pressure, diabetes, heart attack, atrial fibrillation, and stroke. Sleep apnea can also affect your mood, says Dr. Javahari. Sometimes people are diagnosed with depression, but their symptoms are driven by sleep apnea. There is strong evidence that treating sleep apnea can improve depression, she says. One study, published on February 17, 2021 in the European Clinical Respiratory Journal, found that positive airway pressure not only decreases sleepiness and improves sleep quality, but it also eases depression and anxiety symptoms. Both fatigue and depression can sap your motivation to exercise and eat healthy food, two key habits for a healthy heart. And while this particular study didn't show any weight loss benefits from sleep apnea treatment, several others have. Excess weight is a major risk factor for developing sleep apnea. Dr. Javahari says, sleep apnea can occur throughout life but becomes more common with age, and it's more than twice as common in men as women. Heavy alcohol use and smoking will raise a person's risk, as does having a large neck. Diagnosing sleep apnea. If you suspect you have sleep apnea, ask your doctor about an evaluation. If possible, start with or get a referral to a sleep specialist. These physicians are better versed in dealing with insurance-related barriers, and they know how to order diagnostic tests to avoid problems and delays in care. These days, most people are diagnosed with a home-based test rather than spending the night in a sleep lab, which was common in the past. For people whose symptoms suggest they have moderate to severe sleep apnea and have no other significant medical problems, home sleep monitoring is almost as accurate for detecting apnea as a night in the sleep lab. Sleep apnea solutions. The most common treatment, PAP, uses a small bedside machine that provides a stream of air to a mask covering the nose or both the nose and the mouth. The air pressure keeps your airway from collapsing when muscles relax during sleep. Using PAP lowers high blood pressure And while the studies haven't yet proved that therapy prevents heart and blood vessel disease, it may reduce stroke risk. Using the machine consistently can be a challenge, but troubleshooting specific issues can help. The most vital thing is finding a well-fitting mask. People's faces come in all different shapes and sizes, so you may need to try several before you find one that's comfortable, says Dr. Javahari. Using the machine for short periods while reading or watching TV can help you to get used to it. Several other therapies are available, including a pacemaker-like device that is surgically implanted in the upper chest. The FDA-approved device called Inspire stimulates nerves in your tongue and airway muscles to prevent the air passage from collapsing. The latest results show improvement in sleepiness and quality of life in people who received the device. The Inspire device is covered by Medicare and most insurance companies. For more information, see the Harvard Health Publishing Online Guide, Snoring and Sleep Apnea, which is at www.health.harvard.edu/SSA. That's health, H-E-A-L-T-H, dot Harvard, H-A-R-V-A-R-D, dot edu, /SSA. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed it.